I'm feeling left.
Sorry, someone got cut off. Was that Nathan?
Just before meeting banter, we're good.
Oh, good.
Welcome, yeah, you everybody. Turned on the recording. Nobody can talk now.
Yeah, yeah. All jokes are off. Welcome, everybody, to the 25th of August. DIDCOM Working Group B Call. We have a great schedule today, a great agenda coming up by the antitrust policy and the Hyperledger Code of Conduct. If we act poorly, just look sternly at each other, since we all happen to know each other pretty well. I didn't put the meeting link, the agenda link, but I will. That is in the chat. IW is coming up in October. Related meetings review. I would report on the DIDCOM one, only I wasn't there and I haven't listened to the recording yet. One thing that I will mention from there is that there is a company that is working on, they have implemented in two languages, Python embedded and in .NET, the Bluetooth DIDCOM V2 transport written by Timo and company. And so that's coming up. That's not yet released, but they're starting the program, the process for that. I'm excited about that though, because I think there's a ton of really cool potential that uses BLE. So it does some service discovery and some cool stuff. That's the stuff that Timo wrote. And we have more than one implementation coming out. Neither one of them is JavaScript, but having some existing implementations will, I think, make navigating the complexities of Bluetooth quite a bit easier in terms of doing that. They also have two different code implementations so they can demonstrate that it actually works between the two, which is very handy. Other meetings?
Tomorrow. No, sorry, I couldn't find my mute button.
Oh,
go ahead.
Oh, you first, Mike.
All right. So the Cardia users group is going to be kicking off what they're calling the Interopathon this Thursday. The basic idea is that in a couple weeks, we're going to get a whole bunch of participants in the kind of the medical community together to see if all of the agents are compatible with one another using the health schemas that they've decided on. So that'll be kind of a cool community event that shows an ecosystem forming around Aries standards and DIDCOM and things like that.
Do we have any idea which vendors or which code bases are participating in that interopathon?
If I were at my computer, I have a short list right now. Of the people who have already agreed to come. The ones I can remember off the top of my head, there's Liquid Avatar has their own mobile wallet, and they're going to be there. I think we're going to do some demos with the Trinsic wallet. Obviously, Bifold is going to be there. We'll be using the Cardia Enterprise agents. And that's all I can remember at the moment. But there are a couple others.
Cool. Excellent. Thank you, Mike.
Get an idea beyond the medical use case, who's working together, because that helps us know, you know, how things are tracking and also expect or anticipate bugs.
Yeah, I will add something to the today's notes when I find out some of the others or whatever. So give me a little while and I'll add that.
Awesome. Thank you, Mike. Steve.
So tomorrow is the Identity Implementers Working Group call. And I think most of you have been there. So, you know, we go over the a variety of happenings throughout the community and review that. And then also, for our presentation, Horacio Nunez from Kiva was telling me about he's about ready to release an open source desktop tool that will help connect biometrics with SSI backends. And so he's gonna come give us a demo of that. And being open source, I presume it should be available for you to download as well. So that's tomorrow morning.
Awesome. Other meetings.
Sam, you can remove the indie-did method calls for now.
Are we not talking about the indie-did method anymore?
No. Not much is happening there. And indie contributors is the same. Same update continues on. Not sufficient progress to announce anything. So,
okay,
just sad.
A little.
Can I ask why the what's contributing to the indie did method not actually moving forward?
Just
no contributors, I think.
No contributors. Yeah.
It's the not contributing is the problem.
I canceled it each week for a while, and then I just removed it from the calendar altogether.
That's more or less written, right? We just need implementations.
Yeah. And it's still blocked by the CI/CD, which, you know, I thought we were weeks away, and now we're, I don't know how far away we are.
Is there still a standing planning meeting or collaboration place we should go to try to figure out what's going on there?
There's the indie contributors is the only indie meeting going on right now.
Okay.
And it's been dead quiet lately. Just the people who are directly involved with the CI/CD stuff are showing up and that's it. So it'd be nice, but so far not much.
Yeah, I know Mike tried to get involved and was told that they had it covered. So I don't know if that matches your understanding.
What? That doesn't match my understanding, so.
Sounds like we should talk more offline.
I think so, Nathan. Yeah, sounds good.
This is the beautiful moments that these meetings are here for. So that's excellent. Releases and work updates.
Test harness, good progress with AFGO and Akapai credential exchange happening. So that's is happening now. I think both of those PRs are now merged and we've got those things happening on a regular basis. Aries Cloud Agent Python 071RC0 was released yesterday. So it is now out and available, and we expect it's got a handful of things in it that are useful. It's mostly a maintenance fix with a few new features. And we expect that to probably, you know, 071 to be official probably next week, something like that. But we're seeing if there's anything else from the community. So if the community has anything they would like to see in it, please let us know whether we should hold for something that's coming or whether you know, something you need done and we try to get it in before the release. So that'd be great.
Awesome. What's next? We don't have Troy here. Air server JavaScript. We do have Timo.
You're skipping the React Native one, but I'll go first. We not a lot of updates, mostly fixes to the mediation, just making sure it works with Akapai, and I think we're there now. So mostly working on that. I think James is working on revocation, and that's almost finished, I think. So hope to have that ready soon.
Awesome. And back to Aries Mobile Agent React Native.
We just had our call just in the previous hour. Got a demo and presentation on the Aries hooks that we've been working on. So some good UI and code updates, as well as this hooks package has made it significantly easier to integrate into new or existing React Native applications to use Aries Framework JavaScript. So for instance, Neil from our team was able to reduce one component, remove about 45 lines of code, replace it with one line of code to accomplish the same thing. So exciting work happening there, and expect more progress to keep happening there.
Awesome. Did we miss anything? All right, so here's what I have on the agenda for today. So we could talk about time slot review, and I think that today is the day to make the decision. We at the same time probably ought to talk about some adjustments in meeting format. And then the two technical topics, these are both from the from our list of things that we want to talk about that we drummed up a couple of meetings ago. I want to talk about connection reuse and about JSON LD credentials. The JSON LD credentials is more of an exploratory conversation, and to talk about where, you know, kind of where we are and do a bit of a status check, not necessarily a huge presentation about the technical ability of it. So that is kind of what I had on the agenda. Any adjustments we should make before we get going?
I wouldn't mind adding one perhaps at the end or maybe next week, but I'm having a bunch of discussions in W3C VC working group of the basically the mental model of what a verifiable credential is, and particularly around the what a verifier knows about the holder when they receive a proof. Notably, does the is a verifiable credential that issuer A said X, or is it issuer A said X to Y to the holder?
That's part of the semantic meaning of the credential. And if you try to divorce it from the semantic meaning of the credential, you'll tell yourself a lie.
Which do you think is the correct one?
Both are possible, and you have to expect both are possible, and it may vary depending on what kind of credential you receive.
Okay. So, that's basically the conversation. So no need to go into it now, but that's, I wouldn't mind having that conversation to get a feel for what this community thinks. Because I got the very clear message from the W3 VC working group that it's the former only.
That's part of the subject equals holder debate that was never adequately resolved within that group. If they try to pretend that it's resolved, then they're opening themselves up to a slew of security vulnerabilities.
Yeah. To me, one of my proposed solutions is basically the elimination of subject. There is only a holder.
No wonder they're unhappy. Of how the data model was built is that holder has to equal subject. And they even went so far as to debate whether they could disallow any other use case besides holder equals subject.
Yeah, and I think the proper solution is to do just that, is to eliminate the word holder and let the semantic use of the particular credential you're dealing with. But anyway, we're going too deep into this. I apologize, Sam. So
no, that's okay. Let's come back to it, because that's a really good conversation. It's interesting to me, you know, we've been in this space for a while, and sometimes you end up like realizing that there was not a shared mental model when you thought there was a shared mental model.
That's about exactly that. Where I'm at.
And so the good news is I think we're far enough along and have enough experience in some areas that we can actually like have a realization of those things. But it's always a little jarring when something like that occurs. So cool. Okay. So time slot. Here's the results. I have to refresh this. Here's the results of what this is. These are the folks that filled it out. And the way that this works is it shows you who can't attend during a particular time slot. So the most popular ones were right now or 8 a.m. And I don't know how many of the 8 a.m. folks actually usually attend the A call. I usually do. But of course, if this was at the same time, then that would then combine. And this is the main, this availability lines up with the with Stephen's proposal. There's also this one here at 11, but 11 is still fairly late for the European folks, and that was kind of the main goal to actually make this happen. So the proposal here, so this data lines up either, so it seems like we should either leave it alone or move it to 8 a.m. I had a conversation with Robert Mitwicki, who runs the A call that happens in the that happens at that time slot, and he's totally amenable to adjustments. The nice part is the main call would sort of move into the European time slot, which would actually help. There hasn't been a lot of sort of cross call attendance overlap, and so that would actually help quite a bit from that perspective. And that is certainly a move we could that I think is the most obvious one to make. And so we would move it to 8 a.m. Mountain Time. That's 7 a.m. Pacific. And that would be the same time slot that usually is. Thoughts, comments?
So would it combine with the A call or be on opposite weeks, or where would the A call go?
More or less combined with the A call.
Yeah, the URSA call is on opposite weeks from the A call, so I don't think you could do opposite weeks.
And there will be some overlap, but we don't have a ton of overlap with the URSA community, not as much as we'd like anyway. And so that would it would still be a weekly call, but it would occur at 8 a.m. on Wednesday, Mountain Time, 7 a.m. Pacific. And that places it in a more acceptable European time zone from that. So Stephen Curran, thumbs up, because he was the one that formalized that proposal in the last meeting. Other thoughts about this? One notable person we have not had attending is Daniel Hardman. He has moved to Switzerland, and as such, this call time is at a super inconvenient time of his day, and he has not been able to make it. That is not the only reason we're bringing this up, but the Mike doesn't want to wake up early. I hear that. Any thoughts?
I'd like to hear from the Pacific time zone folks, because that's 7 a.m. for them. That is a little earlier than they often do, though. I have to commend them for attending a lot of community calls that end up starting at 7 Pacific.
Beats the heck out of 9 p.m. So I'm good with it. 9 p.m. in Europe.
Not hearing a lot of objections. We don't have Troy on the call. This is kind of an unfortunate time, just we didn't plan this, but we have heard from folks and we've circulated stuff around a lot. So that's there. Related, do we have an afternoon call that lines up with Asia Pacific? We haven't. The largest contingent that we've had in that region has been from New Zealand, and we haven't had a lot of participation from those folks lately. I think they've been busy with other things. So I don't know if we held it specifically for Asia Pacific folks that there would be there. This is one of those like field of dreams things. If you hold the call, will they come? And I'm inclined to say that we continue with just the one call, and then move, or we can add a secondary call to fit other time slots, should there be demand for that. There's a hard thing, obviously, because there's not a lot of demand for it because people sort of feel like it's unavailable. So this is something we'll have to kind of keep an eye on as a community, particularly if we know folks that don't want to be here or that want to be here, but can't be here at this time to really talk about it. Okay, so the proposal then in front of us is that we basically take this call and combine it with the A call. And there would be, we'd go back to just having one Aries working group call. It would be weekly on Wednesday mornings at 7 a.m. Pacific. And it would anchor in the U.S. So that if there's any shifting around of time zones, that's the consistent place where that happens with daylight savings time, et cetera. And so there will be some shifting as it applies to European times, but it'll still be substantially better than it is now. Anyone opposed to basically combining with the A call and making that our regular call every week?
One thing to maybe note, and I think you had this on the agenda, was that the A call currently is an hour long right now versus this call being an hour and a half.
That is true. Lately, though, I feel like we haven't really blown the risk. So there's some historical context. This meeting got made 90 minutes because we repeatedly blew past the 60-minute mark with the discussions that we're having early on in the community. And that's carried forward to be relatively true. And you'll notice in the markup here is that when you go from 8 to 9, we have a ton of people who then can't make it at that time. Yes. So we'll talk about that in just a second. But is anyone opposed to that proposal to merge with the A call and just have the call until we have motivation to add another one for an alternative time zones? Okay. That decision stands. I will go ahead and make the appropriate calendar changes. And I will put a note as well on the wiki that indicates such. There's our two active Zoom links. Probably the easiest thing to do is just leave the A calls there and we'll join that one. Since it's happening in that time anyway. And then we would abandon this Zoom call link. The other alternative that we have is to use this one, since it's traditionally had the higher attendance. And that way people know where to find it. Although if they click on the thing and join at the wrong time, they're not going to find anything anyway. So I think I just convinced myself that the A call link is probably the right one to use. Any objections to that?
I use the A call.
All right. Okay. Meeting format. If we're going to go to 60 minutes, which seems like the prudent thing to do, and I think that would, given our post AIP2 discussions, I think that holding within 60 minutes is likely something that we will be able to do. I wanted to bring up and ask whether we ought to adjust meeting format. We talk about some related meetings and we talk about projects that are going on. With a little bit more time urgency, I think we could, there's some possible adjustments that we could make to the meeting format to make that more efficient. So that way we spend less time doing sort of opening intro stuff and we can get to the sort of the main topic, the main agenda items faster. Any thoughts, ideas, comments?
One suggestion there is it was always intended that the main kind of cross project roundup could happen in the implementers working group call. That happens on every other week on Thursday. So if we can defer some of the what's going on at W3C, what's going on at DIFF, what's going on, you know, everywhere talk to that call, it does leave more room in this call for area specific things. And then my other suggestion is that we want to focus as much as we possibly can on practical code interoperability issues, as opposed to more future talk. The future talk's not valuable, but if we have to squeeze one out, I would rather get more talk on what current code changes affect interoperability between the code bases and, you know, what things we want to implement next, meaning this week, next week, as opposed to stuff that we might get to in 6 months or later.
Yes, certainly a priority for what's happening now. I think that we could remove the related meetings. I'm also happy, though. I think that what we can do is not necessarily call on folks, but we can ask if there's things that people want to announce. And that way there's a chance if there's a special topic that you think would be relevant somewhere else or whatever else, then that it's certainly a place, but we wouldn't regularly, you know, spend meeting time on those.
How about we ask people to update the agenda before each week? In other words, blank out the agenda each week and then have people add it if they feel it's important.
Anyway, that would be a good way of keeping the agenda shorter.
Yeah, and just tell people if you want to talk about your project, then you have to have added it before the meeting started.
Okay. I think that's a good idea.
Well, and as Nathan mentioned, the implementers call, that's kind of what I'm trying to do, is make sure that there are kind of snippet summaries of several of the key projects across the industry. So if people want to join and give updates on their projects there, that would be great. Right now, I kind of just go and glean what I can from meetings I've attended or proceedings minutes that I've read afterwards.
I do like that we talk about the code status of projects in the call. That list kind of ebbs and flows a little bit as there's attention given to projects. But I like that because I think it grounds us in the code that we're producing rather than in conceptual talk. And so I'm inclined to try and keep the regular reports on code for that purpose. It doesn't take a long time. Over the last couple of meetings that we often only spend 5 or 6 minutes, running through and talking about stuff, and certainly saying no updates this week or something is certainly acceptable. But I'm inclined to keep that piece and lose the related meetings piece.
Yeah, I'm in agreement. That's kind of what I meant. In the implementers call, we don't typically have enough time to get into code level discussions. It's a little more higher level, a little more kind of strategic. Did the new Occupy come out? When is this going to be released? That kind of thing. What projects are working together? A little more of that overview kind of perspective. And then the other thing we do is I try to have a presenter present either something deeply code related, a code presentation, they release a new repo, here's what it does, or even something it's a little more high level on the product side. But I don't think there's a conflict, but if that's a good delineation point, I've been trying to keep it a little more high level, but informative across projects.
Okay. I will attempt to make some of these changes. So the ACOL has actually been on a summer break the last little bit. And so we're going to kind of drop into in the middle of the summer break with a call. And so I will facilitate that this week. And I will try and make the agenda available far in advance so that we can kind of adjust it. And after a week or two, we can make some changes or see what we need to do to be able to adjust the format to the current needs of the community. There's absolutely no reason we have to do the same thing that we've always done. And so adapting to our current needs is a much smarter move there. Okay, I will go ahead and do that. Any other comments on the time slot meeting format issues? All right. In the list of requested topics, connection reuse was one of them. And I wanted to bring this up. This is this is RFC 434 for out of band 1.1. And the big addition here was a pattern of connection reuse. And down here in the bottom, there are reuse messages that help clarify. I'm not there yet. Where did I put it? There are reuse messages that facilitate that that process. And so it shows up in a handful of places. Here we go. Here's what I was looking for. So if the here's how this works. And out of band, messages are encoded. The out of band messages are typically encoded into a QR code or a URL. If for example, in the case of a QR code, if a mobile agent scans a QR code that they have scanned before, and this talks about how to actually know that, then they have the option, rather than to go through the dance and create a new connection, but rather to signal across the existing connection to the creator of the QR code that they intend to reuse the existing connection. The reason this is handy is that the thread ID of the QR code, of the message in the QR code, becomes the parent thread ID of the message that actually, when you normally go through an out of band, that's the parent thread, which allows the creator of the QR code to correlate which barcode they actually scanned and respond with the appropriate action, have some context. And so by sending this handshake reuse message, you're basically saying, hey, by the way, here's the parent thread. I just scanned this QR code. And that way it gives an opportunity for the part of the creator of the QR code to respond knowing that context. There's also a reuse accepted message, which indicates to the other party that they understand and the context is actually present, and you can make that happen. And so those are the messages that actually facilitate that process. The nice part here is that as we have things like QR codes, we don't have to, it provides an action, the scanning, it provides an action that the user can take. And if we standardize the process of reusing an existing connection, we can still provide the same user experience of them scanning a QR code, a thing happens, but there's not a byproduct of yet another connection to the same party that exists in the Aries agent. It's worth noting that this is common. However, reuse is common. It's not technically required. It is allowable for the other party to decide that they are not going to reuse the message and want to start a brand new one. And that is really useful in the terms, in the sense of, if they're trying to seek, they're trying to not be known with their previous action, then they are allowed to just start all over again, and that's fine. So that's a brief overview of what the connection reuse is. Are there any questions about this?
All right. One question I have is with the handshake reuse accepted message, having that be a requirement, could that not be insinuated by a different message with the appropriate thread ID?
It could be, but there's this implicit versus explicit debate. And one of the people in the explicit corner is usually Mr. Stephen Curran. Do you have any commentary on that?
Stephen,
there you go.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly... So you're saying instead of responding with a reuse and then doing something, you know what? Now that I think about it, so out of band allows you a handful of ways to connect. So one of the things you can do with out of band is you can say, I want to use this handshake protocol. I want to use DID exchange to establish a connection. Oh, and by the way, I also want to run this protocol, this other thing. The reason I'm connecting is to request a credential. So you can do either or both of those. And if there is a request attachment with a type of activity you want, you absolutely can respond to that one with the using the reusing a different connection, but not bothering with the reuse message. Does that make sense? So there's a table in there that says, well, if you've got a handshake protocol, then you should use reuse because you don't know what why you're being invited to connect. But if you do know why you're being invited to connect because a request attachment was given, well, then go ahead and respond to that, you know, whatever message was asked for, but do it using your existing connection. And you don't have to have a reuse in between.
So what that means then is this must is not entirely accurate. Oh, well, hang on. So I lied. So what you're saying here is that you can send a handshake reuse if you have nothing else to send. If you have something else to send, because there's actually like a request attached that's present, you're not going to actually use that and send it along. If you use a handshake request, then the other party doesn't have anything to actually say and should and must respond with a reuse accepted.
Yeah.
So what that clarifies that I was not clear in my initial explanation, in that if there are the reuse message allows you to send a message back and forth when there is not a request actually attached. Otherwise, you could just go ahead and respond to whatever this request is. With the appropriate parent thread that lines it up with the context of the QR code.
Correct.
Does that help, James?
Yeah, that aligns with what I was thinking there.
Okay, so I did not say that very clearly the first time through.
Yeah, this table came out. I was working with, I think it was Renata at Evernim on this, and this table became fairly useful. What are the preconditions to this? What's being asked for, and then how can you respond to it?
So, who's built this?
I think we have, but I'm going to have to question that. I think Akapai has it, but I would hope. But
does Akapai have the capability to bundle request attachments with it, or is it just the handshake protocols? For, well, you said you would have to check, but that would be something that...
Certainly it has the request. It has, I think the whole out-of-band is fully supported.
I don't think it supports the reuse yet. At least I haven't seen endpoints for it. Like it supports including request messages. So that you in the out of band you can include a credential for something, but yeah. I haven't seen endpoints for the reuse.
Really? That's bad. Okay. So that's why I was not being 100% clear on that. Which means I gotta follow up.
And I'm glad you brought this conversation up, Sam, because I was actually going to be researching this and what what Akapai supported and such, because looking to add support for reuse messages in AFJ and figuring out what is involved to do so. So as far as I know, this isn't something that we support TMO and AFJ, but correct me if I'm wrong on that.
No, we don't even support the out-of-band protocol yet. So lots to do still.
So in particular, this is mostly useful with client apps that actually scan stuff. So if Akapai at least has partial support of the back end, on the front end, obviously, if it needs to be an AFJ support before it can end up in bifold. Are there any other front-end client applications that do connection reuse? Okay, so not enough yet.
Well, so the enterprise agents that we're doing for Cardia are going to need to do connection reuse, but they're using Akapai, and so seems like they should be fine, right?
As soon as Akapai has it.
Oh, was I not paying attention? Does Akapai not have it yet?
Akapai has at least partial support, but perhaps not full support.
Okay.
I'm asking.
I, I mean, we support it in evidence stack, but I mean, we did most of the early drafting of the spec and stuff like that. But we support both the request attach and the
Connection reuse. Very cool. Awesome. So we definitely have partial support.
I guess I was imagining that was something that we would be interacting with people on. So
we definitely, I think, need to, right? But we haven't really got there yet. So I think one of the useful pieces of making this happen would be to sort of promote this within the community and get the support that we need so that we can demonstrate and make it happen.
Certainly we could, not a test case for it in the test harness. We haven't implemented all of the test cases yet.
Sheldon's been adding that, but I checked and I was asking, are you using the handshake reuse message? And that the impression I got was yes. But as I say, you know, Timo, if you think it's not there, then that can't be what he's using. So I got to check on that.
I may be wrong that. So don't quote me on it.
Oh, no, I've done that. I've told the team, Timo says.
I know. Now I'm worrying.
Okay, so we have a couple action items here. One is increased ACCPy support, and the other one is some AFJ support so we can get bifold support for this. And that would be a great thing to interop test with Evernim's ConnectMe app. That seems like a great exercise to do that. Cool.
Okay. The quick answer from Shanjot was yes, it does. So I can get more details, but it appears ACCPy supports it. So
cool.
Could it be that it supports it like? Only from one side, so a holder sending like I want to reuse it, but it doesn't expose it in the admin API.
It may just be an automatic response.
That's what I'll have to have a discussion to see. I'll ask them as we go, but anyway, go ahead.
Well, my next question was any final comments on this topic? So
that's fine. We can take it up on the Aries channel.
Awesome. Identifying gaps and then doing some testing would be fantastic. That's awesome. Okay. All right. Next up on the agenda is some talk about JSON LD credentials. I was addressing this separately from BBS Plus signatures because the BBS Plus is, of course, adds some extra abilities to JSON LD based credentials, but you still need that. So JSON LD credentials are different in the sense that they are more or less a way of signing a credential and not really, and they're not, it's not, the holder is less involved in presenting JSON-LD credentials as a proof. There is a presentation that you go through, but there's a lot less manipulation and math that goes on as part of that process because it doesn't, without the BBS Plus signature stuff, doesn't require the native stuff. So here's my three questions. What support for JSON-LD credentials already exists? What support is in the pipeline of various projects in the community? And I wanted to ask a question about JSON, about the JSON-LD completeness. And what I mean here is that JSON-LD has the technical ability to reference and rename things so that you could combine various types of things, rename fields so they merge together, et cetera. And I'm curious what both the current state of implementation is about JSON-LD support. or what the thought is as a community we should target when we start talking about the full world of LD completeness and the types of features that would be supported there. So that's a lot. So first question is what already exists? I know that Akapai has at least a little bit, and I believe more was added by Timo for the creation of JSON-LD, the issuance of JSON-LD credentials. Is that correct?
Yeah, Akapai supports. All right, go ahead, Steve.
No, go ahead, Timo. You know way better than I.
Yeah, we have an initial implementation with support for BBS signatures and also for ED25519 signatures. So one CKP, one non-CKP signature suite. And it's implemented with DITSOF and DITKEY for now. I think that's what we have at the moment. We haven't looked at like some of the renaming stuff that you just mentioned. I'm also not sure and like how automatically handled that is by because we just use an JSON-LD processing library, like how well integrated that is in these libraries.
So it's got support to do it. Is there a way to signal via the credential issuance protocols to say I need a JSON-LD credential? And then you get one back?
Yeah. So with the attachment registry you have in the V2 protocols, you can send like which formats you would like, and Akapai supports. Like you can, I could, for example, offer you a credential where I offer you both an indie and a linked data proof credential, and then you could just request the linked data credential, and then we will issue that one. You could also request both, and then you will have like the same credential in two formats, which will make proofing easier and less dependent on the specific signature types the verifier supports.
Cool. Okay. Other systems that support LD credentials. Are there any AFJ support yet for JSON-LD credentials?
I mean, it's just a mystery for us. We're, you know, how to actually make use of it is interesting. You know, one of the sad parts of DID Indy not existing is we can't put other than, you know, we don't support on an indie ledger other than ED25519 keys. So we can't use indie as a way to do BBS plus credentials, for example. The overall overhead and how you're supposed to handle and cache LD contexts, that's tricky. As soon as you open the conversation of, oh, what do we want in the credential, it becomes an entire committee. I'm not sure what you meant by the renaming. Is that the localization features of LD?
Well, you can have a context that refers to another context, but renames it. So the context can say, hey, it shows up as X in here, except that the X is the same as Y over there.
So my assumption was an LD processor would do that and that's just there. And then it's just a matter of what you have in the, you know, the various contexts that you reference, but that was always what I assumed, but I have heard a lot about the toolings week, so I don't know.
Well, so I think there's two options here. One is a full LD processor, which should do all of that stuff. The other one is you assume a fixed context, which means you're basically going to do a string match on the context to make sure it's what you expect. And then your code is just going to know what attributes should actually be in there based on that.
And from what I understand, you know, the lecture Manu always gives that it's a security hole to load context dynamically. And you're never supposed to do that. So, that makes it interesting, let's say. security risk.
So that's interesting.
You know, how a holder is supposed to operate if it's not allowed to load a dynamically load a context, I have no idea.
You said a holder or a verifier?
A verifier, I can understand, because the verifier is the one that's going to do a proof request. And so it can say, I want this. But a holder who is going to get arbitrary, collect arbitrary credentials from a set of issuers, that's pretty hard to me. It's the holder I see as the tricky one.
So is this, I've heard also a lot of things. Isn't this something that should also be, for example, solved by governance frameworks or trust registries, in the sense that I think the main thing what is the security concern is that you have a URL, and if you resolve it, like the context URL is not part of the signature. So I could present you a credential and completely change the context URLs, and you wouldn't know because it's not part of the signature. So if you then, I want to, yeah, forge something, I change the URLs, I show it to you. So what you should have is, like, for every URL that exists, you should know what a trusted resolve is of that URL. And it could be just by an external thing that provides that trust to you. I think there will be a lot of work in it, but I think that's the main thing. So you can't know whether that context URL is actually tied to the credential you're receiving, which it seems a bit weird in my opinion, but I think it has something to do with extension and all that kind of things.
Well, and this isn't we don't have the same problem exactly with indie ledgers, because it comes off a ledger, which means that the schema is immutable. So,
well, there's several other issues with both the canonicalization algorithm and how the unique identifiers are generated inside of the graph to make sure that you know how the graph is serialized. And if you can't divorce yourself from the unique identifiers that the issuer issued during proof presentation, you can't accomplish independence between the holder or the issuer and the verifier the way the verifiable credentials expects. So yeah, I kind of feel like we're trying to solve the easy things without solving the most important things the way we're going about this. Because if we can't solve the holder, the GUID problem for canonicalization and signing, the rest of this doesn't matter much.
Could you explain the GUID problem?
So my understanding is, when we have a JSON-LD graph, we use a unique identifier for the scope of each element in the graph in order to make sure that we can serialize it in a specific order and that we don't get cross matches off of duplicate objects inside of the graph. But that means that we're signing an object that has unique identifiers in it, and there's no way to do a subject binding that doesn't require the disclosure of those unique identifiers, or better said, those unique identifiers leak into the thing that the holder needs to present to the verifier. So even if we do a blinding technique for subject binding, the underlying data graph that you signed leaks unique identifiers that could be compared from one verifier to another verifier. Now, I'm not certain of all the specifics on that. I think that's one of the things that the Diff Crypto Working Group is or is going to be working on, to try to figure out what needs to happen.
So some stuff generally to figure out there.
But until then, like, in terms of privacy preservation and it making it so that we have kind of the data economy of the issuer-holder relationship is independent of the holder-verifier relationship, JSON-LD is a non-starter until that's solved, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, JSON-LD is also a non-starter for privacy until you have BBS plus signatures.
I think we're overselling how much BBS plus signatures will help.
Well, there's nothing privacy related before you actually have anything. JSON-LD credentials are not a privacy preserving credential technology natively. You cannot, there's no, there's, right? Because you have to present the full credential, which means it's fully correlated.
Yeah, I just don't know why you wouldn't just use JOTS or just do the standard OpenID connector or OAuth attribute thing at that point, because you don't buy any independence from the central issuing authority.
No, you don't. But it is basically a nice standardized way of signing something. Right? Like there's cases where you're making an assertion about something that doesn't really need to be privacy preserving. I'll give an example. Steven's not here to defend himself. But in the case of some government thing, you know, you can have public records issued that are signed. Let's say it's a health inspection passing, that you could just issue that and it could be stored somewhere and everyone can verify that that credential is actually real, but there's not really a need because of the public record nature of it to actually preserve any of the privacy involved in that credential itself. Which means that might be a reasonably good use for JSON-LD-based credentials.
Well, at that point, why aren't you just certificate authority signing something and slapping it on the website just using the URL?
This is basically just, yeah. Well, the reason why is because of the rest of the infrastructure built around us, right?
But it's a little bit like saying the best way to deal with a kidnapper is to pay the ransom. I mean, because the point of making the data independent was that the holder could present wherever and however they wanted. We're saying, no, they can't, or if we're leading them to believe that they can, but we're not actually giving them the ability to do that in any secure way whatsoever.
Well, I think part of the problem, Nathan, is that we in the indie community started with a very narrow set of applications for these credential technologies, which involves people and holders. And that's, I mean, this relates back to the question that Stephen answered at the beginning, but one of the issues is that I believe that there are valid uses of credentials that are institutional in nature that still benefit from the standardization efforts that we're going through, but don't have the same requirement profile or the same privacy profile requirements because they're dealing with institutions or otherwise public data.
Well, and that's where I would come back and say, if you really truly believe that, try re-architecting your system using a centralized API from the issuer. I think you'll find it an easier system to deal with.
I think it would be an easier system to deal with. But there are that's in the short term. In the long term, I think there's some other advantages of being able to do stuff in a different way. So, and you ask, why don't you just sign something from a central authority and post it on a website? You can, except that there's not a standardized way of actually doing that. And so I think that the effort around credentials is less about privacy preserving and more about having a unified way of actually passing these assertions around, even if they're not privacy preserving in any way. And I believe that there is some value there.
But don't you think maybe like that's where linked data proofs could be used for then, and that credentials should have been privacy preserving from the start?
Well, that's linked data proofs are JSON-LD credentials, or am I crossing something?
Yeah, but it's built on top. So you could see like credentials are the layer on top of it that are by design, like take these things that we want for credentials into account.
Right. So I see what you're saying is, why don't we just base it on the lower layer? You could, except no one's done that. Right? No one's actually made that step to define something based on that standard. So there's a couple things that we gain by this community effort on credentials. One is good crypto that solves privacy. Another one is just the ability to facilitate and pass this information around in a understood manner. And even when you don't have the privacy requirements or ability based on the credential technology, I still think there's value in having a standard way of asking for passing, presenting, receiving, et cetera, passing these credentials around, even if all they are is JSON that's signed, but it's done so in the JSON-LD proof manner, such that it's consistent enough that we can make good use of this and we can build tooling, et cetera. So you're right, Nathan, it didn't have to be built this way, but It can be, and I actually think there's value in doing so. It also, I think, makes it a lot easier to draw the line and differentiate between privacy-preserving credentials and non-privacy-preserving credentials in really important and useful ways. I think that's my assertion, is that, like, that's why you should do this. Now, there's also the promise of BBS Plus. It has some features. Some features are expected or imagined, or we're pretty sure we can do it, but we haven't, like, knocked that out yet. But and that gets back into the privacy preserving side of things. But I do believe there are still actual benefits of being able to work with JSON-LD credentials for those use cases where it doesn't actually matter.
Well, and I would strongly, strongly suggest those that believe that to show up at the crypto group, because the cryptography discussions are not nearly as optimistic.
That the promises of BBS Plus will come true? Is that what you mean?
Or that they solve some of these other specific shortcomings, meaning just adding the BBS Plus part is probably not the hardest part here. So it's just something that I want to make sure the community is aware of where that's at and is participating in trying to solve it. Because if they're thinking that the BBS Plus stuff will come out of the crypto side of the community and it will just work, I think we're all setting ourselves up for a long slog of disappointment.
That caution is worth hearing. Okay. So we have some support in ACAPI. Timo, do you happen to know if the full LD processor is in use, or is it doing a fixed context?
In ACAPI, there's a full LD processor in use. It's just I don't know enough about the really low level internals of Link Data Proof and to know like how that works out of the box. ACAPI is a full LD processor created by Digital Bazaar.
Okay. Awesome. I think that gives me the information which I was looking for, which is that we've got a little bit, and I know that no one's here from the Go team, but I know Go supports more of this. And so that's helpful to know too. Cool. All right. And with that, I think Stephen left. And we may have already had a half of that conversation anyway, but I'll bring this up for next week. And that way we can talk more deeply about this. Anything else for our meeting today? All right. Next week, we'll be at the new time on Wednesday morning, and it will only be for 60 minutes. So we will see you then, and I will publish far and wide to make that known. And please, if you know other folks that aren't here, go ahead and let them know. And that way they can hear from multiple places and more likely to make the transition with us. I'll probably also likely show up at this time next week on this channel, just to catch anyone that sort of didn't get the memo. And let them know of that change that had happened. So I'll probably plan that, probably at least 1 week of that as well. Sounds good, folks. Thanks for coming. And we'll look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you.